Welcome, everyone, to Citizens Climate University, a weekly webinar program of Citizens Climate Lobby that is providing CCL volunteers like you and I with access to in-depth training opportunities on topics relating to climate change and effective climate advocacy. I'm your host tonight, Brett Cease, and our topic is carbon tax economic modeling, a live Q&A. And joining us tonight is CCL's research coordinator, Jerry Hinkle, and Columbia University's Dr. Noah Kaufman. A quick introduction about Jerry. Jerry is an economist in banking for the last 30 years and holds master's degrees in economics and climate policy. He's been lobbying Congress for climate solutions since 2006 and has served as a regional coordinator for CCL since 2011 and is now one of our research coordinators. He's also had an active role in CCL's Speakers Bureau, now the Presenter and Schedulers Action Team. And with us tonight is also the wonderful Dr. Noah Kaufman. Noah worked in energy and climate change policy in both public and private sectors. At World Resource Institute, Noah led projects on carbon pricing, the economic impacts of climate policies, and long-term decarbonization strategies. Under President Obama, he served as the Deputy Associate Director of Energy and Climate Change at the White House Council on Environmental Quality. Previously, he was a senior consultant in the environment practice of NERA Economic Consulting. He received his BS in economics cum laude from Duke and his PhD and MS in economics from UT Austin, where his dissertation examined optimal policy responses to climate change. He's published in peer-reviewed journal articles, several of which he'll discuss on tonight, on the social costs of carbon dioxide emissions and the role of other risk aversion in environmental policy evaluations, among other topics. So thank you so much for being on the line, both of you, tonight. We cannot wait to jump right in. After tonight, attendees will all be able to have the following learning goals met: understanding the general economic impacts of some of the recent carbon tax economic models out there. We're focusing specifically on Columbia University's Center on Global Energy Policies models tonight, and lightly we'll touch also on Stanford's Energy Modeling Forum 32. And also, we'll be able to contrast the findings from this recent research with each other to articulate how it compares to our own carbon fee and dividend policy and pose economic and carbon tax modeling questions in real time with the primary author of several of these reports. So to do that, we're going to give a quick background and provide some grounding in CCL. And then Noah's going to jump in and compare three different economic modeling pathways, talk about what to do with the revenue, what some of the positive and negative, the pluses and minuses of the economic effects are out there. And then from there, do a little bit of analysis on the Market Choice Act that Columbia University was responsible for. And then we'll open it up for Q&A beyond that. So with that, sit back, relax, enjoy the show, and thanks again for tuning in, everyone, tonight.
Thank you, Brett. 2018 has seen just an abundance of very strong peer-reviewed economic and environmental analysis of various revenue-neutral carbon tax policies. In January, a full book was published called Confronting the Climate Challenge, U.S. Policy Options by Stanford's Larry Golder, Mark Hafstead of Resources for the Future. So one of the nice things about this is, you know, sometimes you'll read an article on analysis. Well, this is soup to nuts. This is 280 detailed pages of their model and the results of their model for a revenue-neutral carbon tax. Then in February, the entire February issue of the journal Climate Change Economics was devoted to these peer-reviewed models evaluation of revenue-neutral carbon taxes, 15 articles. What they did was take 11 different models, strong models from all over the world, and ask them to answer the same questions. So they had four basic revenue neutral carbon tax policies: $25 plus 1% plus 5%, $50 plus 1% plus 5%. This volume is really going to give you some detailed information on various views, how revenue neutral carbon tax will impact the economy and the environment. Then in July, Noah's work began coming out. First was is sort of a grouping of three different models, four different models used to evaluate similar carbon tax policies And then just a couple of days later, when the Curbelo legislation came out, or the Market Choice Act, they had asked Noah and his group, the Carbon Tax Initiative at Columbia University, to evaluate that. Where CCL is with us, this is a remarkable quantity and quality of work that we absolutely should embrace. So we simply did a canvassed our volunteers to say, does anybody have expertise in science? Does anybody have expertise in policy or economics? And we formed teams that are making contributions to our policy efforts. There's probably 10, 12 people, economists, on the Economics Policy Network. Of those five blogs, I think I wrote three, and others were written by Bob Archer, Jonathan Marshall, Dana Nusitelli, people in this Economics Policy Network team. It's fabulous work. And so, yes, if you're interested in the science, the policy, the economics, and contributing to our volunteers in that way, please just drop me a line at jerry@citizensclimatelobby.org. Incredible material. How we have addressed this with you to this point is this series of five blogs, the last one of which is not coming out until Monday. But these have been our way of communicating with you what these articles say, what it says relative to Remy, what it says about our policy, and how it supports the work that we're doing. We'll probably do a presentation in November as well, possibly June. But for now, what you have with respect to this material and how it relates to our work are these five blog posts. The economic message for CCL, as I think in some way, shape, or form, Noah will tell you, is a very strong one. Economists have been some of our best allies. And that is really it for me, Brett, and I very much look forward to Noah's presentation. I've gotten to know him over the months and really appreciate his work and thrilled that he could take the time to be with us tonight.
Entirely agreed, Jerry. So with that, let's pass it to you, Noah. We know that due to unforeseen circumstances, there was no power in your home, and you've had to generously find the nearest Wi-Fi here right before joining us tonight. So for the listeners tuning in later, if you hear any background noise during Noah's talk, know that he's at a coffee shop. We're aware of that and trying to still maximize the listener experience. So with that, the floor is yours, Noah. We can't wait to learn from you. Thanks again for being here tonight.
Great. Well, thank you, Brett and Jerry, for the generous introduction. It's a pleasure to be here. I really appreciate the invitation. Speaking to you all tonight is great. I've had the pleasure of coming across folks from CCL for probably a decade now. I don't know, at least 5 years. And I have a huge amount of respect for your organization. So hope to continue the engagement going forward. Jerry teed it up very nicely about the research effort that we have ongoing at Columbia. I guess just very briefly to explain, I work at the Center on Global Energy Policy at Columbia University. Our goal is to just provide objective, independent, and policy-relevant research. So we're not advocating for anything in particular. We do have a carbon tax research initiative. So we're not advocates, but we kind of accept the consensus that putting a price on carbon is pretty obviously a good idea. We're sort of moving past that argument and instead looking to provide policymakers with information on design options and the implications of those options, really with the expectation that in the near future this will be a sort of relevant topic at the federal government that's going to heat up in years to come. I think you're already seeing some signs of that, although of course with the caveats that you all know. So I guess to jump in, actually, just one more thing to tee it up. I'll just mention that I think Brett generously mentioned that I was the author of these papers. I sort of directed the effort and edited all the papers and wrote a summary paper, but it really was a collaboration between a bunch of different groups. We had the Rhodium group doing modeling on energy market impacts, emissions impacts for us. We had the Baker Institute at Rice University doing macroeconomic modeling. And then we had the Tax Policy Center, which is part of the Brookings Institute and the Urban Institute, doing distributional impacts modeling. So it really was a big collaboration. And that's sort of to give them credit and also to say, I wasn't the person actually running these models. So if you ask really difficult questions, it's very possible I'm going to have to say, I'm going to go ask the modeler and come back to you. So I encourage you to ask those questions, but it's certainly possible I won't have an answer. This slide, what shows is that we've looked at, among these three different modeling teams, three different carbon price pathways. You can think of it as a low pathway, a medium pathway, and a high pathway, calling those our $14, $50, and $73 per ton scenarios. We have not looked at a sort of price pathway that starts very low and rises very quickly to a high level. We hope that will change very soon. And let's talk a little bit about emissions impacts. This slide is basically to show what you probably already know. Price signals work. Greenhouse gas emissions fall. In all of these scenarios, on the left-hand side here, you see a current policy scenario where these are emissions in 2030 compared to where they were in 2005, which is sort of a common metric you see all the time. Emissions fall in all the different scenarios. If you look at our central scenario, the $50 per ton scenario, emissions are in the 40% level, 40 to 50% below 2005 levels by 2030. So that's well beyond sort of the U.S. commitments to the international community and sort of on the way to deep decarbonization by mid-century. The other thing you see in this slide on the right-hand side are the impacts by sector. And I think the thing that jumps out, obviously, is the disproportionate effects in the power sector. Can't read it on my slide, but I think it's about 80% of the reductions by 2030 come from the power sector. That's at least in our model. I think that there's reasons to be skeptical, by the way, of all of these modeling results. These are just projections using a certain set of assumptions that may or may not come true. But I do think it's probably a robust result to say the most cost-effective reductions right now are in the power sector, and that's why we see the disproportionate amount of emissions reductions happening there. So if we move on to the power sector impacts in particular, so what would a power sector look like in terms of fuel use both now and out to 2030 again? That's what this slide shows, and it shows percentage. So this is the percentage of electricity provided by different fuels. And across the bottom, you see coal, natural gas, nuclear, and then renewables. And a few things jump out at you from this slide. Number one, you hear this trope all the time that coal is dying. Coal is actually doing okay in the current policy scenario. It's still almost 30% of our electricity in 2030. Where coal really starts dying is in the high carbon price scenarios. If you see our $50 per ton scenario, it's almost wiped out by 2030. And where does that go? It goes to some extent to natural gas, it goes to nuclear, and it goes to a large extent renewables. I think the short answer of why it's happening is because in the power sector, you've seen alternatives to fossil fuels get so cheap. So this is solar, this is wind in particular. I mean, efficiency is cheap too. That switching away from coal just dominates the near-term emissions reductions. Because when you put a carbon tax in place, right, you're just encouraging all the cheapest emissions reductions to take place. So even more so in the past, those are just disproportionately coming from the power sector. And there's a lot of emissions in the power sector, so you can get a lot of emissions reductions in the early years without having too large of an impact on emissions in the transportation sector. So you know, that's just what the model is showing. I mean, I think from a sort of climate advocacy perspective, there's a few different ways to look at that. Number one, first of all, an economist might say, it sort of is what it is. As long as you're achieving the emissions reductions that you want, it doesn't matter where they're coming from. I think the other side to it would say transportation is sort of too important and we can't wait. And, you know, getting started on these, whether it's rolling out electric vehicles or enhancing public transportation, these are going to take a long time. And there's going to be important effects of sort of starting that transition. So these results to those people would say sort of increase the need for sort of complementary policies aside from carbon tax in the transportation sector. So another key energy market impact that I wanted to point out, you can see on this slide, are the effects on petroleum production across the different scenarios. And this is kind of striking because the tax is applied, and in some cases very strongly, to petroleum, and yet you do not see much change in production. And there's a few different reasons for that. Number one, there just aren't the same amount of, the same number of cost-effective alternatives in the transportation sector where petroleum is used. U.S. producers can also export petroleum, which makes a big difference. To some extent, this may be the function of sort of the model's sort of inability to see major changes into the future. But I do think, you know, the idea that we can put a tax on carbon that achieves significant emissions reductions in the near term without a large effect on the petroleum industry is sort of notable coming out of these studies. This slide shows the effects on coal production and demand. I already really talked about how coal falls off a cliff. It's just sort of, we saw it in the power sector. It's really economy-wide. Yeah, this has implications that I talked about earlier. It also has really important implications for communities whose economies are dominated by the coal industry. And Jerry and Brett and I were talking about this before the webinar started. You know, I think whether it's through the carbon tax policy or beyond, you know, this is a small industry, but it dominates certain parts of the country. And both for, I think, political and also moral reasons, it's important that we have separate policies or sort of policies alongside the carbon tax to help mitigate these effects. And then we didn't talk too much about natural gas. This shows the effects of the different carbon tax pathways on natural gas production and demand. And what you see is in the early years, it actually goes up because of that shift in the power sector from gas to coal. By 2030, what you have are renewables starting to come on stronger, and you also have natural gas and heating being reduced quite a bit. So you have natural gas sort of falling off a little bit. But this increase in natural gas, sort of combined with the effects that you saw in petroleum, I think what you're seeing there is carbon capture and storage in natural gas starting to come online. And I think that $73 per ton scenario growing over time is just enough to that you really do start to see it growing, you know, not a huge amount, but enough that it shows up on a chart like this. Finally, I have a slide here on, this is the effects on per capita energy expenditures. So just total energy expenditures in the whole country divided by population, right? And what this shows is what they were historically over time on the left, and then what they would be in these various scenarios. And it shows, as you would expect, the carbon tax raises energy expenditures anywhere from about 5% to about 25%. So that's a, you know, a decent amount increase, especially a 20-25% increase in energy expenditures. But this also shows it's really not out of whack compared to where they have been in the past, particularly back in 2008, at the time of the commodity boom. Moving on, you know, I think what drives me really crazy is when you see sort of analysis of a carbon tax that talks about the changes in energy expenditures and not about where that money goes. And of course, that money becomes revenues to the government, and the government can do productive things with those revenues. So that, of course, was an aspect of our work as well. A carbon tax would raise quite a bit of revenue across our different scenarios, anywhere from in the $50-60 billion per year range for the low price scenario, all the way up to the $200-300 billion a year in the high price scenario. In these scenarios, the revenue is actually fairly constant over time, even though the tax rate is increasing. And that's because what we see is the tax rate increase is being counteracted by the fact that reductions are falling. So you have a higher tax rate, a lower tax base, a roughly flat revenue use. This would not be the case, of course, if you had a very different tax rate trajectory. So moving on, there's a lot of different things the government can do with that revenue. One thing I like to point out is that we can't agree in this country on what to do with any government revenue. There's no reason to think that would be any different for a carbon tax. And people have all sorts of different opinions on where government revenues or carbon tax revenue should go. This slide lists five different options. You could take the revenue and reduce other taxes. As you all are very familiar with, you could just divide it up and send checks to people. You could use it to reduce the deficits. You could also use it to fund clean energy projects, which I think in particular for lower carbon taxes, people think if it's not enough, we need more policy. And this is one sort of natural way to fund additional clean energy or climate mitigation or adaptation. So this slide does is basically explain why we might do any of these. We might want to go with any of these options. And then the second line here shows the potential magnitude of doing them for the $50 per ton scenario. And of course, in reality, there's no reason we'd have to do only one thing with the revenue. It could be a mixture between a lot of these options. So what are the economic effects of, essentially what you have are the pricing, the price changes, which by and large are negative, right? And then you have the revenue use, which this is the government using the revenue in hopefully productive ways. So that's a positive. So where does that all shake out? So a few different things I want to say about this slide, which looks at the sort of aggregate effects on gross domestic policy or GDP. So first of all, you see in the title, it says policy costs only. So what that's supposed to indicate is that we're not accounting for any of the economic effects of the benefits. So that includes mitigating climate change, but probably even more importantly in the near term, that includes effects on local air pollution, which could be very large and it can include not just health impacts of air pollution, but also economic impacts like effects on labor productivity or medical expenditures, for example. What this slide shows is that the positive effects of the revenue use and the negative effects of the prices change more or less offset each other. So on the right-hand side, I think this is sort of the take-home message here. You see GDP after 10 years in the light blue bars, and you kind of need like a magnifying glass to tell the difference between the bars, right? They're pretty much the same level of GDP in our models across both the current policy scenario and then all of the different revenue uses and carbon tax levels. So we did all this work, and it told us the effect is very, very small. When you do use that magnifying glass, what you see is on the left-hand side here, in some structures you see a positive economic impact, and some you see a negative. What our models tend to show is that if you use the revenue in a way that is sort of, that the model sees as pro-growth, so if you reduce taxes, which causes businesses to want to hire more, invest more money, if we reduce corporate taxes, for example, that's going to spur economic growth even further. In all these ways, you're giving the money back to people, but that's going to go an extra step further in spurring growth. And what that does is, in this case, lead to sort of the positive GDP impacts. The more negative impacts you see for the equal rebates and for the deficit reductions, for example, for the rebates, you're giving back the money to people, but you're not adding that extra incentive. That's not to say it's not a good idea. There are plenty of other good reasons to give out the money and rebates, as I'm sure you all know, especially from EMF, which Jerry mentioned earlier. And this slide is sort of a bit of a mess. It's all the different models that EMF used, looking at effects on GDP for different price trajectories and different revenue uses. The reason I like this slide is because it pretty much does the same thing as the one that, you know, the bars I showed before that were about even, you know, in each of these little boxes, you see those X's and squares and triangles and circles, and they're pretty close to each other. This is the sort of echo growth of the economy in each of these scenarios, which shows it really doesn't make too much of a difference what the price level is, how much increases, or how you use the revenue. The economic growth that we see, at least from our models, is pretty similar regardless. And speaking of which, another thing we looked at was distributional impacts, which essentially this says, look at consumers across the income distribution. So in this slide, they're broken out by income quintiles. So this is on the left, the poorest 20% of countries of the country by income, all the way over to the right, to the richest households by income. And this chart shows how folks' tax burden changes due to the carbon tax policy. So this includes both the change, the carbon taxes they pay, and then the revenues that they receive. By and large, the effects are pretty small. Certainly one bar that sticks out over all others on the screen is the yellow bar in the lowest income quintile and the second income quintile for the per capita household rebates. When you send equal checks back to people, poor people tend to pay, at least on an aggregate basis, a lot less of the carbon tax than rich people. So if you're sending them equal checks in return, they do very well. So you see poor households somewhere between 1% and 5% reductions in their tax burden on account of this tax. So the next two slides deal with issues that actually we did not report on in our studies, but I think they're so important that I just wanted to say a couple words on both. One is regional or state impacts across the country. And they vary quite a bit. So what this slide shows is just carbon intensity by state, which correlates very strongly to how much of your electricity generation do you get from coal. You see the impacts would be felt very differently in states like Wyoming and West Virginia on the left than they would in states like Washington State or Idaho on the right. This, you know, brings up all sorts of interesting political issues that there's really no way around the fact that this is going to be part of a policy discussion, especially for members of Congress. The second thing I wanted to mention, sort of alluded to this earlier, were the potentially large co-benefits from reduced air pollution. So what happens is you put a price on carbon, even though you're trying to get at those greenhouse gas reductions, you end up reducing emissions of other pollutants also. And there's a study that came out recently related to the effort that Jerry spoke of earlier. That showed some really big potential impacts just looking at the power sector and NOx and SOx emissions. These are large impacts, reduced premature mortality, reduced asthma cases, health impacts, and the associated economic impacts could be very large. We used a version of the NEMS model that EIA uses, but the Rhodium Group has their own version of this model, and they built it out in various different ways to be what we think is more conducive to showing a clean energy transition. And actually, that was one of the ways was to sort of enhance its capabilities of showing at high carbon tax levels how CCS might come in, both in the power sector and in industry. NEMS in particular, I don't think the standard version of NEMS has CCS in the industrial sector coming in at any reasonable carbon tax levels. So at especially the high carbon tax levels, we do see some CCS from natural gas. We're talking about just a few percent starting to come in the late 2020s. Not too far before that, though. And we don't do our energy market model in the past 2030 just because we deem it to be too speculative after that. So Jerry mentioned earlier that we sort of had the opportunity to do an independent evaluation of Congressman Curbelo, who's a Republican in Florida. His bill came out in July, coinciding with his bill's release. We released our own evaluation of the energy market emissions and economic impacts of his proposal. So I'll just say a few words about it here. We again are not sort of advocating for this proposal. We're just sort of trying to explain the potential implications of it. And I can certainly see pros and cons of it versus other options out there. For one thing, the price level, it starts at $24 a ton, which is sort of in the middle of the range we looked at before, but it only rises to 2% per year. So it stays fairly low over time. And for that reason, you just don't see the emissions reductions that you would see for a higher price level. On top of that, one distinct element of it was that the proposal actually repeals the federal excise taxes on gasoline and diesel fuels. Those pretty much counteract the effects of the carbon tax in the transportation sector. So essentially what you have is no policy at all on transportation emissions, which I should mention, I think is actually important. You know, even though you weren't seeing the emissions reductions in transportation in the previous section, you still had the price signal in place, number one, raising revenue, and number two, encouraging businesses and investors to look for sort of low carbon solutions in the future as that price signal gets higher and higher over the next few decades. You would have a lot less of that for this proposal. And then the last thing to mention is the revenue use. 70% of the revenue from this bill would go to infrastructure package, essentially replacing where the gas and diesel tax money was going, and then adding to that to sort of fully fund our highway system. And then a handful of other programs got a bunch of money also. There's a specific carve out for low-income households that I'll talk about in a second. The congressman was pretty clear that this wasn't necessarily his preferred revenue use. It was more one that he thought might have some political viability today. So I'll go into just, I think, two slides of what we found in terms of results. Number one, in terms of the effects on emissions, even though it's a relatively low price level, it's still a carbon tax, and really any meaningful carbon tax, what you see is a distinct break from our current emissions pathway. And, you know, these are emissions reductions of 30 to 40% by 2030. So straight line pathway, that's something like 70 to 80% by 2050. It's, you know, maybe not enough for some climate advocates, but it's certainly a distinct improvement in terms of emissions reductions than what we're seeing today. And then specifically, I wanted to point out the results we found on effects on low-income households. So our modeling capability was a little limited in this regard. That's a metric that comes out of the model that essentially says what is sort of the lifetime welfare effects to any given household of this policy. And I'm happy to send you sort of specific gnarly details of specifically how that's calculated. But essentially what it means is like some metric of lifetime utility. So that's it's mostly dominated by income over time discounted. It supports 20% actually, divided into three different groups that are three different lines on this chart. And what we did was see how the effects of the price increases to those households compared to only the effects of the 10% of income that was specifically targeted to them in the bill. And these are the results we found. And because of our model, they're actually separated by the age of the recipient. But by and large, they're above zero, which is telling you that if you target a certain amount of money at low-income households, as they did here, that's a lot of money. And it's actually enough in the vast majority of cases to make these low-income households whole.
So there's a bunch of different carbon tax proposals that do something like this with a small portion of a revenue. And what you end up seeing is that they're not super progressive in the way that a sort of are able to make at least most low-income households whole. In that sense.
But what's going to occur that the markets are poor at capturing? So how might the results be likely to differ from the model? And then let me just give you my second question, and I'll mute myself. It's what do you think of the Market Choice Act?
We've talked about this a little bit in the past, and I appreciate you teeing me up because I forgot to mention a few of things I certainly like to mention when it comes to the limitations of the models. I did mention, I think maybe the most glaring weakness is that they deal only with policy costs and not the economic effects of the benefits. I mentioned that one. I'd say the other very big one that Jerry, I know you're focused on also, is that they don't really do anything with the sort of incentive for innovation or induced investment. So essentially, one of the great advantages of a carbon price is that you put a price signal in place, and especially if it's very high in the future, businesses, investors, entrepreneurs all see this, and they say, the opportunity to invest in clean energy is much better now than it was yesterday without the carbon tax, because the product I'm going to produce is likely to have a higher market share in the future because of that carbon tax. And not only that, we're deploying more of these products now, and then you have these learning by doing effects, whereby the more deployment, as we've seen this with solar energy over the last 10, 20 years, the more we deploy, the cheaper they get. For whatever reason, we haven't figured out a good enough way to implement that effect in these models. And almost embarrassingly, because of that, we assume it's zero, which has a real potential bias. I would say, in our defense, we're a little, I think, more cognizant of this than most groups, and that's why we don't show point estimates. So you see in basically all these emissions reduction slides I showed you, we show a range, and that range is coming from sort of a range of technology pathways over the future that in part is supposed to capture this effect, the idea that, the carbon tax itself would be expected to induce faster clean energy innovation, which would reduce emissions more, and it would also lower the costs in terms of economic costs of any policy. And the second question you asked, what do I think of the Curbelo bill? In my official capacity at Columbia, I'm indifferent to it because, we're just trying to display the sort of implications. I think it's a great improvement on the status quo, people should respect the fact that our emissions reduction pathway is pretty flat right now. It would dramatically change that, and I think that's important. And it's a carbon tax, so it would change it in a cost-effective way. That said, there are ways that personally I would change it if I was designing a policy. And I mentioned the transportation sector issues. It's not really a transportation sector policy at all. And I think the carbon tax pathway, especially over time, is maybe a little low as well.
Is there any interest with Columbia to include a modeling, considering a pathway that would be akin to CCL's price ramp of $10 a year increase over the percentage, on top of inflation?
Yeah, funny you should mention that. We are sort of in the process of sort of building out our sort of capabilities. And, this wasn't a one-off project for us. We're going to keep doing not only modeling of real-world proposals, but also continuing to look at sort of specific issues of interest over the next couple of years. Certainly see looking at a CCL-like pathway as falling within that scope. So we're going to look at different policy pathways, particularly ones that are proposed in Congress or presidential campaigns, and then also try to dig into details like So I mentioned state level impacts before. If any carbon tax policy gets to a serious level of discussion in Congress, we're going to need to know specific granular level impacts of them. So that's something else that we're going to be thinking about going forward too.
If you have any questions that didn't get spoken to or you'd like to follow up with after tonight, Noah's been kind enough to share his email. Here's Jerry and I's as well. We'd absolutely love to be in touch with you. We want to make sure that this is something that you can continue to build on and not just a one and done. So I'll put those in the chat window as well. But from the bottom of all of our hearts at CCL, for the work that you're doing, the essential research you're providing the academic community, Noah, thank you so much for giving time tonight to share with us your research, your perspective, and how we can use it with our own advocacy. Have a wonderful night, everyone. I'll unmute all lines.
Thanks,
Noah.
Thanks
so much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Looking forward to being in touch with you.